Hello and welcome to another edition of Mooney Goes Wild in the Garden. Let me begin by telling you that in a couple of weeks' time, the 31st of May, we'll be moving to Sunday at 6 p.m. on RTE Radio 1, so make a date in your diary. But never fear, we'll still be here on Monday nights because we're celebrating 25 years of broadcasting on Radio 1. We're going to dip into the archive and bring you some of our best material from that quarter of a century. But we begin tonight with a little bit of a mystery. Richard Collins is in Malahide. He's not the mystery. Good evening, Richard.
Hello, Derek.
Richard's in his back garden, and Niall Hatch is in Greystones in County Wicklow. Niall, good evening.
Good evening, Derek. That's right, here in lovely Greystones. Lovely day today, and lovely sort of sea breeze coming in, so it's nice and cool. Nice place to be.
Now, just a few moments ago, I sent a photograph to Niall, and you can have a look at it on our website. It is of an empty eggshell, which I found in my back garden near the partition wall with my neighbour. And it's pure white, I mean proper pure white egg, and no contents inside, they're gone. And I imagine the base of it, because it looks quite pointy, with the bit that's left, has been removed, and I'm just wondering what it is. So I sent a picture to Niall. Niall?
Yes, it is indeed an interesting egg. Judging by the size of it, I asked you to put down a little marker so I could work out like from reference what size it was. So you kindly put down a AA battery, which is about 5 centimeters in length. So that was able to show me that, based on the size, that it's the egg of a collared dove. All of the pigeon family that we have in Ireland, at least the pigeons and doves, they have white eggs, and they're a bit more rounded than a chicken's egg would be. A chicken's egg is very pointed at one end, very round at the other. You still get a bit of that with pigeon and dove eggs, but they're more rounded, almost like a slightly squashed ping pong ball. And obviously the collared dove is a bit smaller than a wood pigeon. So when I can see the battery reference there, I can see that that's what it must be. And also, because the egg is clearly broken, it's just one half of it, it's clear that what happened was that the chick in this case successfully hatched out of the egg. If you find an eggshell and it's smashed into bits and there's maybe bits of yolk or wet material inside it, that's usually a sign that a predator has got to the egg and has managed to eat it, unfortunately, before the bird has hatched. But what happens is the young birds, if they hatch out, they break it more or less into two quite neat halves. And then the parents pick up the halves and they carry them away from the nest and they drop them, which is presumably how it turned up in your garden. The doves, they could have carried it quite a distance from the nest. So that's what it is. Yeah, absolutely. At this time of year, we're getting lots of records of people finding eggshells, sending them into Birdwatch Ireland, sending photographs in. And it's a really interesting thing to do. It's great for kids as well, because it really shows that different birds have different types of eggs, different colours and so on. And it's also a sign that, summer's here. The birds are breeding at the moment. The breeding season's in full swing and there's lots of eggs in the country at the moment.
Why didn't it eat the eggshell? I'm just curious. Some birds do, don't they?
Some birds do, yes. It depends. Normally, if the bird is going to lay another clutch of eggs soon after, the female may eat the eggshell because she needs that extra calcium in her body. But in many cases, birds don't do that. They just carry it away. So something like a blue tit, for example, which only has one clutch in the year, it would have no need to eat the eggshell. It's already built up its calcium reserves again. It doesn't have need for more. Whereas birds like swallows, they usually carry the eggshells away, but on occasion they will eat them because they have a lot more eggs to lay. Their breeding season is just starting. They may have two or even three more clutches. So it depends very much on the species.
Now, some sounds rolling away in the background there of the cuckoo. We were talking about the cuckoo last week. Rosemary Cullen sent in this video with the sound of the cuckoo, which she recorded in Virginia in County Cavan last week. Any updates on cuckoos, Niall?
Most of them should be here at this stage, and calling should be at its peak at the moment. So our cuckoos, they tend to arrive in usually during April. That's when the bulk of them arrive. And some of them will start singing immediately when they get to the coast. Others will head inland to places like County Cavan and will take up a sort of a singing territory and will sing away. And then what they do is for much of the month of May, they'll spend their time singing. What they're doing, of course, is they're trying to attract the attention of as many females as possible. So then hopefully if this male is successful, he'll get to mate with several females. And then that's his job done. He has no need to sing anymore. He doesn't need to defend a territory for any other reason because, cuckoos don't have nests. So there's no nesting site to look after. There's no chicks for him to feed. So once the mating is finished, that's his job done. He'll sort of feed up for a bit more, and then pretty soon after that he migrates back to Africa. He doesn't need to stick around. So usually by July or early August, our male cuckoos are gone, and you won't hear that sound anymore. The females will hang around a little bit longer. They're laying eggs, but again, of course, once their eggs are laid, That's their job done as well. They don't need to stay around because they don't raise their own chicks. So they head back to Africa. And then the youngsters usually stay with us until around September. And then they migrate to Africa without any help from their parents, of course. They've never met their parents. They don't even know that they're cuckoos. That migration journey is pre-wired into their brains, which is, you know, it's something that is genetically encoded. And I find that just amazing that, you know, that nature it's just so resourceful in that way. And that natural selection can actually evolve migration routes. It's absolutely incredible. So this year we've seen a good number of records of cuckoos to our Spring Alive project. That's springalive.net. So anyone hears a cuckoo, or indeed a swift or a swallow, or sees them, or a sand martin, go to springalive.net and report it there. And certainly the numbers of cuckoos that are being reported to that, they're up this year on previous years. Now, I don't think that's because there's been an increase in the cuckoo population. It's a species, unfortunately, that is declining in Ireland and is nowhere near as common as it used to be. I think it's because of the lack of traffic noise at the moment. The sound of the cuckoo is actually carrying further. And so people are hearing it from a longer distance. They're hearing it from their houses. In a normal year, they probably wouldn't. So I think that may be what's going on. But as Birdwatch Ireland survey work goes underway under the summer and we're able to do more of that, we'll be able to get a truer sense of the actual numbers of the cuckoo population. But certainly the number of records we've received are up. But I'm attributing that to the COVID restrictions, really.
If you're listening in at home and you have a recording of a cuckoo in your area by sight or by sound, you can get in touch with springalive.net, which is managed by Birdwatch Ireland here in Ireland. Now, a video that I made myself along the River Dodder recently. Have a listen. Now, what a beautiful sight. Look at this. It's a little egret and it's doing the egret shuffle. Now, look under its body. Look at the yellow feet and you can see that it's kind of shuffling its feet. You see that? It's trying to disturb the prey from the rocks and then it pounces. You can see its whole body shiver when it does it. Now, these birds first came into Ireland. I think they started breeding in Cork in the late 1990s because I remember talking to Jim Wilson on the radio about it at the time. And that's where I first saw them. And I heard that they were here on the River Dodder, but it's the first time I've actually seen one. And it's a real treat, I have to say. It's a beautiful bird. You wouldn't expect to find a bird like this in Ireland. It's a relative of the heron, the grey heron that we have here. Just watch it now and how it does its business. See the feet? You can't miss them. Yellow, black legs, black bill, white feathers, bright yellow feet. Probably the exposure on my camera isn't that great, but it gives you an idea. So if you happen to come along a river and you see a bird like this and you're wondering what it is, it's called the little egret. And that little dance it's doing is called the Little Egret Shuffle.
So little egrets on the River Dodder, Niall. Was I right? I was going by memory there, thinking out loud that they first started to breed here in the late 90s. Was it around Belvelly in Cork or somewhere like that? Well, certainly Cork Harbour.
Yes, around there, yeah, sort of the southern coast. So it was 1997, and that sort of area in Cork and the Cork-Waterford border around Youghal, that kind of area, that's where they first took hold. And since then, they've gradually spread along the south coast and up the east coast, and it's now, I wouldn't say common bird, it's locally common in some areas, but definitely increasing, and people are seeing them more often. And I've seen one in the Dodder myself, actually, a few months ago, and it does seem to be a favourite spot for one little egret in particular. It seems to like feeding there in the water. And as you pointed out in the video, you can very clearly see those bright yellow feet that it has and the way it's doing that shuffle in the water. It's trying to stir up any kind of little invertebrates or tiny little fish or tadpoles even that would be hiding under the stones maybe, and they would dash out. Another thing that they'll do with those yellow feet is they'll go to quite a shaded area, maybe on a riverbank or in slightly murky water, and they'll just stand at the edge, they'll put their toes in the water, and they'll wriggle their feet very gently. And what happens, a passing fish would just see that as being like, you know, they wouldn't see the black leg, they'd just see these three yellow sort of wriggling things. They think they're worms. They come over to investigate, to try and eat them, and then of course they get eaten themselves. They become the meal. So it's really interesting hunting strategy. The little egret is a member of the heron family, so the grey heron would be the more familiar member of the family here in Ireland. The little egret, it's about two-thirds the size of a grey heron, so still quite a substantial bird, but not as big as a grey heron. Pure white, and at this time of year it's got these two big plumes that sort of fall down the back of its head, which you can see very clearly in your video. One big difference between them and grey herons is the way they feed. Grey herons are much more patient. They'll stand in one spot, they'll wait sometimes for hours for a fish or a frog or a mouse or something to swim or to walk past. Whereas the little egret's much more active. They dash around, they run around chasing things. So that means that the two of them can coexist quite happily side by side because they're not competing for the same food resources. And indeed, they nest in the same breeding colonies. So there's, if you remember a couple of years ago in the Dawn Chorus programme, we had the microphones up in St. Anne's Park there. Yes. in Raheny in Dublin. And we had them in the grey heron and the little egret colony. And those little egret chicks make the most bizarre sounds, these really bubbling, rasping noises. It's really, really odd. We don't think of them being very vocal species, but the youngsters are. It's amazing that these birds are now nesting in Ireland. I remember seeing my first ever one. I was a child. It would have been the early 1980s, early to mid-1980s. It was in Booterstown Marsh in County Dublin, near to Black Rock, right beside the Dart station there. And there was bird watchers from all over Ireland there to see that, a big twitch for this rare bird. Now you go to Booterstown Marsh and you could see a dozen of them at one time. The species has really taken hold here in Ireland. Originally, it's a Mediterranean bird, a bird from Africa, the Mediterranean region and southern Europe. But over the latter half of the 20th century, the population moved further and further north until, as you said, by the mid-1990s, they were here in Ireland breeding. And the reason for that seems to be climate change. This is a species that needs access to unfrozen water during the winter months. And up until a few decades ago, places like France and Germany, the Netherlands, that would have been the case. They would have been completely frozen in the winter. They no longer are. That gave this bird a chance to spread further and further north and keep going up, like, you know, sort of almost like stepping stones until it got to southern England and then from there to southern Ireland and then has spread. So real success story, great bird to have here. But of course, the fact that it is here is evidence that climate change is really altering our landscape and our environment. And that's a scary thought as well.
Well, you can see that little egret to get a good impression of what it looks like on the website rte.ie/Mooney. While you're there, you can watch this video, which has been sent in by Janet Walker and her son Jaden, who live in Clane in County Kildare.
My cat was just trying to eat the bird in my back garden. There's no blood, there's no marks.
And he can flap or fly.
He's flapping, but he's not flying. I think he's only a baby.
And he can't chirp.
And we don't know what to do with him. We have a little cardboard box.
Yeah,
that we're going to put him into.
I'm making a bed right now. See, I flap it. So bad.
My camera is not focusing on him. Well, he's blinking and moving. And there is the cat.
Oh dear, Niall, what should she have done? Now, we've been in touch, needless to say, with Janet. What was the advice?
So when anyone finds a little chick like that, when it's out of the nest, the most important thing is to get it back to its parents as soon as possible. Obviously, in this case, there was a chance that the chick was injured. So to check to see if there's any signs of bleeding or any kind of broken wings. And if that is the case, then it would need veterinary attention. There's a great resource online, a website called Irish Wildlife Matters. So irishwildlifematters.ie. They have details of rehabilitators who can assist. But that should only be in the case where an animal is injured. In almost all cases when young birds are found, if they're very, very small and they've fallen out of the nest, the only real long-term chance of survival they have is to be popped back in the nest as soon as possible. Now, in this case, the young sparrow was actually very well advanced. It was actually okay for it to be out of the nest. It had fledged already. Not probably able to fly, but that's perfectly normal. Birds often leave the nest before they can fly, and it takes them a couple of days to learn that. And people sometimes find them and think that they've been abandoned or been orphaned. Almost never the case, though. What's happening is their parents are watching them from a distance. They're coming to feed them all the time. And in most cases, just leave them as they are, and they will be fine. Now, some cases, of course, cats and other predators may get them and a cat could bring them inside and very often kill them. If the bird is still alive and uninjured, just get it back outside as fast as you can to its parents. Pop it up into a hedge or into a tree so it's off the ground. Just a word of advice to cat owners, especially at this time of year when the young birds are just out of the nest and they're very naive, they're not aware of predators, they're relying on their parents to keep them safe. Cats pose a real threat to them. So if at all possible, to keep your cats in just during this next few weeks, that would be really a big help to our bird populations. And it's especially important early in the morning and late in the evening when the birds are the most vulnerable. But cats do a lot of damage to birds. Of course, it's not the fault of the cats. They're only doing what comes naturally to them. But in a way, it is the fault of the cat owners, I'm sorry to say. You know, they're not a native predator. The birds can't cope with them, particularly the young ones. And it does a lot of damage.
They kill hundreds of millions of birds worldwide every year, but they're not the only predator for birds, are they?
No, no, there are many. And the sad fact is that most of the young birds that are fledging at the moment won't survive for terribly long. It's only the very wiliest and the very luckiest that actually make it to their first birthday and then go on to breed themselves. There are many things. So things like grey squirrels, they're a big predator of birds, particularly eggs and of chicks. It's when they're still in the nest. Rats as well. Sometimes mice too, but rats even more so. And of course, squirrels and rats, they're rodents, so they're a type of mammal. They have a very good sense of smell, so they can detect where the nest are and where the nestlings are. Birds mostly have no sense of smell at all, so they don't hunt in that way, with the exception of some seabirds and some vultures. But mammals like squirrels and rats can. There's obviously other natural predators that we have, so neither the rat nor the grey squirrel are native to Ireland, but we do have native predators, things like sparrowhawks, some members of the crow family, all sorts of things will do that. So, you know, it's part and parcel of nature that one animal eats another animal. You know, people complain about this or think that it's bad. Of course, most humans eat other animals as well, so we're kind of having a bit of double standard there. But also, think about birds like robins and blue tits. They're voracious predators as well. Over the course of the nesting season, just in a period of about 2.5 weeks, a pair of blue tits will murder up to 10,000 baby butterflies to feed their chicks. That's the way nature works. There's nothing wrong with that. They're not going out of there thinking, I want to end a life, I want to kill something, that's going to be great fun, or they deserve it, or anything like that. They're doing it because they want to feed their chicks. It's just the source of food that they have. So yeah, it's being a bit facetious, but it is perfectly normal. It's part and parcel of nature.
He's been very quiet today. Richard, do you want to say something?
Derek, you were talking earlier about cats attacking birds, and the bird that came into my mind at that time was the Eleonora's falcon. Now, the Eleonora's falcon is a most interesting bird for a number of reasons. It's a very odd falcon because you'll see it going around in flocks. If you go to places like Mallorca, for instance, the Greek Isles and places like that, you will see Eleonora's flying around in flocks, and they breed communally. But the most interesting thing about them is that they breed very late in the year, August, September kind of time. They're on eggs. Why? Because they're catching the young birds going back from Europe to Africa and feeding those to their chicks. They are timing the breeding for the maximum amount of food available, and that is when the chicks are going back to Africa. Now, they're called after a famous lady in Sardinia who was Eleonora. And Eleonora was the first ruler to decree that falcons' nests and hawks' nests should be protected. She was an original conservationist, and she is the heroine of Corsica. Now, a few years ago, in an island off Morocco, a group of zoologists examining Eleonora's falcon nests found little birds still alive, which seemed to be trapped in little holes in the rocks beside where the birds, the Eleonoras, were had nests. These little birds were in crevices and little caves and holes and things. Now, they came to the conclusion that these birds had their wings clipped and their tails clipped so that they couldn't fly, and that they were trapped there deliberately by the Eleonoras, and that they would be a food source for the Eleonoras. The Eleonora caches food. It kills things and builds them up, about 10 birds lying beside its nest a lot of the time. But this was a case of keeping the birds alive. Now, their theory, these fellas had, was that it kept the meat fresh. In those warm countries, if you kill something, it begins to go manky very quickly. So by keeping the birds alive, then you would keep it fresh for longer. Now, this, when it came out, was challenged, I'm afraid, by a South African zoologist in particular, and he claimed that it was most unlikely that Eleonora's falcons would be capable of doing such a complicated thing of knowing to pluck the birds and finding a suitable little prison for them, and it showed a degree of premeditation and cognitive skill that was beyond what an Eleonora's falcon was capable of. And they suggested that the possible reason was that the birds were brought back in the normal way, alive, to be fed to the chicks or something like that, but they somehow managed to escape and fell down into these crevices where the Eleonoras couldn't get them, so that they weren't in fact a deliberate larder set aside, living larder, but they were trapped victims of the catches that the Eleonoras had done earlier.
Have you heard about this debate, Niall? Have you ever seen an Eleonora's falcon yourself?
I have. They're magnificent birds. I've seen them in a couple of places. There's quite a sizable breeding colony on Cyprus, for example, and that's a very good place to see them. And in the Canary Islands, you can find them too. On some of the small islands off Lanzarote, they breed, and you can then see them flying over to the mainland from around the north of Lanzarote. They come in two different colour types. There's some that look a bit like peregrine falcons with sort of pale cheeks and brown bodies with streaks, and then there are other forms of them that are really, really dark, almost pure black. So they're really interesting. They have these two phases. And they're a very late nester. They time their nesting to coincide with the autumn migration of songbirds. And from what I've seen, you know, unpleasant though it may seem, it does seem that in many cases they do deliberately catch these songbirds, incapacitate them, and wedge them into these cliff faces. It seems to happen around Eleonora's falcon's nests more so than around other birds. I'm sure occasionally a bird does get stuck by mistake, but it'd be very rare for that to happen. A bird wouldn't normally enter a crevice that it couldn't get back out of. They'd have no reason to enter that crevice. So I do think it is the falcons doing it. To us humans, that's, of course, very distasteful. It seems very unpleasant. But that's nature. They're not doing it to be malicious. They're not doing it to be nasty. They're doing it because they want to ensure that there's enough food to feed their chicks. They have a very narrow window of time in which to get that food because the migration season is so short, and they've invested all of their resources into raising those chicks. That's the way nature works. It's not for us humans to make value judgments on that or to say one animal's good, one animal's bad. It's the way they behave. I think that a lot of other creatures, if they looked at the way humans behave, and you know, they'd be pretty disgusted with us as a species. That's not to say that all humans behave that way, but some humans do some pretty bad things. And I think that the big difference between us and the falcons is that we know that we're doing that and we do it deliberately. The falcons just do what they're pre-programmed to do. So we shouldn't judge nature by the same standards that we judge humans.
Okay, now I'll stay there if you would, because you're going to enjoy this next item. Well, when I say enjoy, you're going to find it very interesting, because when we think of COVID-19, we tend to focus on how we humans are affected, and rightly so. But what about primates, our closest living relatives? Are they susceptible to the virus? The official website for Virunga National Park in Democratic Republic of the Congo reads as follows. As a result of the rapidly unfolding situation regarding the global spread of COVID-19, Virunga National Park has temporarily closed down the mountain gorilla tourism following advice from scientific experts indicating that primates, including mountain gorillas, are likely susceptible to complications arising from the COVID-19 virus. As such, we must remain steadfast in safeguarding our population of this endangered species. And they are right. About one third of the world's mountain gorillas live in Virunga, while the others live between Rwanda and Uganda's Burundi Impenetrable National Park. Journalist Jack Losh has been in Burundi earlier this year, where groundbreaking gorilla conservation has brought about a rare conservation success story. But could COVID undo much of the progress made? Jack joins us now from Gloucestershire. Richard, that's all yours.
Hello, Jack. You have been writing about one of our nearest relatives, the mountain gorilla. And indeed, it's an animal with a sort of success conservation story over the last few decades. Would you agree?
Yeah, so I was privileged enough to be sent off into the heart of Africa in southwest Uganda a couple of months back to go and meet one of our closest simian ancestors, the mountain gorilla. It's hard to think of any other primate that is more iconic than that subspecies. But there I was, deep in the Burundi Impenetrable National Park, and I came very up close and personal, not just with one mountain gorilla family, but two. I was only due to meet one, and another one kind of ambled onto the scene. What is so extraordinary about that is that if I take you back to the dark days of the 1980s, when poaching, habitat destruction, and disease had all but wiped out the subspecies, there was just a few hundred left in the world, that kind of close encounter with two families would have been completely unthinkable. And yet here we are in 2020, after three decades of a concerted conservation effort, and their numbers have risen dramatically to more than 1,000, and we've reached a stage where they've been upgraded, their status has been upgraded from critically endangered to endangered, but they're not out of the woods yet.
Well, now you say you were up close and personal. Is there any remote prospect that you brought COVID-19 to the gorillas? And if you brought it, would they suffer from it?
I certainly hope that I didn't bring COVID-19 to them, but to answer your second question, yes, there is a distinct risk of that happening. Mountain gorillas share about 98% of human DNA, which makes them particularly susceptible to respiratory diseases like COVID-19. Now, since this pandemic has happened and it's sweeping increasingly through Africa, I was lucky enough to get in there just before the lockdown happened. But since then, wildlife rangers in Bwindi in Uganda and other surrounding national parks are taking precautions because the risks are so serious. In fact, they're so serious that scientists recently warned that if COVID-19 got into the mountain gorilla population, it would be a potential extinction level event. So what rangers are doing now, they're wearing masks, they're having to disinfect their boots, they're wearing gloves, and they have to maintain a social distance from the gorillas of 10 metres. So these are the precautions that they're taking, because if the disease gets into this rebounding yet still very fragile population, the impact could be devastating and reverse these almost miraculous gains, which, as we see other animals sliding towards extinction and unbridled habitat destruction across the world, you know, the gorillas really stood out against that in a positive trend. The fear is now that disease could reverse those amazing gains.
Well, now, when you were there, how close did you come to these gorillas?
Well, the guidelines are a few metres to stay away from them. But, you know, these are wild animals. They're inquisitive. And against maybe their kind of stereotypical image, which is a hangover from the colonial period, these aren't savage wild creatures. They're actually gentle giants. They're incredibly curious and profoundly intelligent. In fact, if you look into the eyes of a gorilla, it's impossible not to see that ancient connection that we share with them. And you just wonder as well, as they look back into you, do they notice that same ancestry as well? So with that in mind, it's pretty hard for them not to get up and close to you. I had this amazing experience towards the end of my visit to them, where this cute little fluff ball of an infant gorilla came ambling right up to me and went right through my legs. So sometimes it's impossible not to maintain the safe amount of distance just because they're so intelligent and inquisitive.
It sounds like they are conscious of performing and that they welcome visitors coming to look at them, and that if we stopped coming, they would be upset or feel lonely. Now, COVID-19 is going to drive tourists away. Is this going to affect them psychologically, do you think?
There are some gorillas out there which are still not habituated to humans. I mean, over many decades, this subspecies has been brutalized by humans, whether by poaching, hunting them with hunting dogs, getting caught in snares, causing permanent deformities to their hands. So some of them are understandably wary of humans. And then there are families who, over the years, during conservation efforts, have been habituated to us. Now, whether or not they're going to get lonely, I can't really see that happening. I mean, every day we're still having ranger patrols going to see them, and they're very content in the habitat. But the big problem is, with tourists not going in there, is that conservation and law enforcement around protecting this subspecies, the main funding for that comes from ecotourism, namely Western European tourists going into Uganda and Rwanda, and to a lesser extent DR Congo across the border, and paying $600 per person in Uganda, up to $1,500 in Rwanda for just an hour of the gorilla's time. That is bankrolling most of the protection and conservation of these animals. All of a sudden, that crucial source of ecotourism dollars has evaporated overnight. What this means is, right now, ranger patrols are continuing pretty much as usual, albeit with the appropriate kind of precautions like face masks and gloves. But in a few months' time, and you know, I've heard this directly from people on the ground involved in the animals' protection, they're going to be running on empty, and it will be impossible to fund that level of protection. There's another risk as well. It's not just the gorilla conservation that depends on tourists. It's also the local communities around these national parks. So if you think that, you know, thousands and thousands of villages are getting indirect benefits from all these tourists coming in. So, you know, you might be employed in a hotel, in a restaurant, as a porter, as a ranger, as a cleaner around the park. You might be doing traditional dance for tourists, or you own a trinket shop. All of a sudden, these rich, wealthy American and European tourists coming in, they're no longer there, and they're not spending their desperately needed money in the community. This is pushing a lot of people surrounding Bwindi and the other parks to the edge. And as they run out of money, some of them will be forced to turn to the protected areas of the forest to look for bushmeat. And in fact, I was speaking to an aid worker on the ground just the other day, who said, yeah, normally this time of year, you might not see any poachers for months. And in recent weeks, there's been 4 poacher arrests, which does indicate that already the strain of lockdown is beginning to bite. And normal, but, you know, poverty-stricken people who don't have any other option are now turning to the forest to survive. That is a great concern. The dry season is coming up, when, you know, farming and agricultural produce will drop further. That's going to increase pressures even more. So if this lockdown sustains, we're going to see greater pressures on this already very delicate, very fragile, slowly rebounding habitat.
Is there a prospect of reducing? The cost of this is enormous. I mean, would I pay huge sums like that? I would love to walk with gorillas and have one run between my legs, as you had, but I would not be prepared to pay those enormous sums to do that. And when you have to consider the airfare and the hotels and everything else, it is a thing that only the very rich can attempt to do. Is there the prospect that of the prices coming down and enticing more local people to come and see them? Would that work?
Yeah, I mean, already kind of local people, Ugandan nationals, they can go to the parks for greatly reduced fees, which is fair enough. But you know what? It depends what model of conservation you buy into. This model is very much the kind of Western militarized model of conservation that's been in vogue for many years. And fair enough, you know, we've seen the increased sophistication and militarization of poachers who cross borders, who are heavily armed, who have contacts in the Far East and all over the place and can make serious money and are armed to the teeth. There was this very interesting report that came out from Credit Suisse a few years ago that said up to $400 billion is needed to conserve healthy ecosystems, yet only around $52 billion of this, so what's that? That's about an eighth of this, is raised. So that's leaving a dangerous shortfall in our capacity to protect these ecosystems. That's one model which needs a lot of money, and it's clearly failing because it's dependent on people's ability to fly to other countries. And of course, flying to these other countries puts greenhouse gases into the environment, which in the long term is going to pile even more pressures on the environments that we're hoping to protect. So it's a kind of absurd, vicious cycle. There is another model, and to understand it, I've got to take you back to the early 1990s. In Bwindi Impenetrable Forest in western Uganda, where an indigenous minority known as the Batwa were living. Now, they've lived there for millennia, countless thousands of years, living in harmony with nature. And the kind of indigenous tribal community view of these ecosystems is not separate from human beings on the one hand, animals on the other, but instead they fully embrace the holistic connections that exist between all beings, whether human or non-human, in an ecosystem. And that has led to a very sustainable way of living for many, many years, because they understand the laws of nature. Now, these Batwa people, the indigenous people, were forcibly evicted from Bwindi Impenetrable Forest in the early 1990s to make way for this conservation project. which is completely absurd because these are the very people who have developed this ancient, age-old knowledge system for conserving and living in harmony with their environment. The great tragedy of the mountain gorilla's rebound is that it's come at the expense of these Batwa people, also known as pygmies, which is a, you know, an old-fashioned colonial term. They're now living on the edge of the forest in absolute destitution. I mean, their living conditions are so appalling, it beggars belief. And the knowledge system that they've gained over thousands of years of protecting and living in harmony with this environment is disappearing. It's been utterly squandered as rates of addiction and depression rise among them. So what I'm trying to say is there's a whole other model which we can adapt, and it's embracing the indigenous people who have been persecuted by the kind of more militarized model of conservation, drawing them in, collaborating with them, having a much more cohesive approach. They have an ancient knowledge that provides solutions to the modern day challenges that we're facing today.
Well, would these people now, could we avoid the kind of fortress conservation that is the model out there at the moment? If you bring these people in, you rehabilitate them, you pamper them a bit, and they, let's suppose they do come back, would they be able to resist the huge forces, military forces, the dreadful sort of trade in wildlife parts and so on that's going on? Would they be able to withstand that, do you think?
That's a good question. I think it's very easy to overly romanticize indigenous cultures, and given the threats that the environment faces today from these pretty sophisticated transnational militarized units of poachers, yeah, they probably couldn't stand up against that. The problem is we've gone so far the other way, kicking out the very people who kind of know how to manage these ecosystems inherently in their communities, that we've lost something as well. So perhaps there's a more balanced approach, a kind of a more collaborative approach between, on the one hand, the kind of iron fist of law enforcement, armed rangers, but also then the kind of velvet glove over that iron fist approach of using these indigenous people, bringing them back, reintegrating them into their environments, bringing back their knowledge systems and drawing on their beliefs. And I think that combination really is the only way forward.
Jack, this little gorilla that came up to you, were you not afraid he would scratch you or bite you or do something very strange? You let him run under your legs. I mean, how did you feel in that situation?
Well, the little tyke gave me a bit of surprise, but that kind of sense of surprise was quickly watered down by the delight of being in such proximity to a beautiful, intelligent, inquisitive creature that probably wasn't too different from what I was when I was a kid. The lead up to that was we'd been trekking for a few hours through this thick, densely woven environment of kind of vines and trees and leaves. And at the time, I was trekking alongside a vet, part of the Gorilla Doctor Task Force. You kind of go in there and keep an eye on the health of these creatures. And we're clambering down this forested ravine when he looked at me and he knew the apes were close. He said he could even smell them. And it was at that point that the mountain gorillas came into view, high in the canopy, plucking leaves, chomping on the vegetation. Then an adult male slid down a tree. More followed with these infants and juveniles in tow. And the icing on the cake was a huge, grunting silverback descended to join its family as all the branches buckled beneath around 400 pounds of this iconic primate. At the very end of the tour, I was with some other tourists, some other rangers. They headed off. I stuck behind to take a few more photos. And it was really a truly humbling and enchanting scene. By that point, the gorillas were remaining completely disinterested in these alien simians, i.e. us, the people. And as we began to depart, I saw the silverback recline on a bed of leaves, gently watching over his relatives in a landscape that for some 25,000 years hasn't changed. And today it stands as an awe-inspiring tangle of vines and creepers across this ancient rift valley. Hopefully, the future of these gorillas is safe, but with the arrival of these new threats, not just COVID-19, by the way, but habitat destruction and climate change, there is still a great deal of uncertainty around their survival.
Jack, thank you very much. That is fascinating stuff. I look forward to your next article.
Thanks very much, Richard. Good speaking with you.
Thank you very much indeed, Jack and Richard. Niall, it's an interesting story, isn't it? It's not something we would probably think of immediately when we think of COVID-19.
Absolutely, but of course these primates, these great apes, our fellow great apes indeed, they are very closely related to us. They have very similar biology and they could very easily be susceptible to many of the same diseases. We know that they're affected by some other human diseases, and when it comes to COVID-19, I think it's very much important to err on the side of caution, because a disease pandemic could wipe out that population. It could actually make the species extinct, so it's really important that they're protected.
Now, I want to take you back in time. In 2010, UCC, that's University College Cork, became the first university in the world to be awarded a green flag from the Foundation for Environmental Education. UCC ran the pilot Green Campus programme with support from Antashka after a group of students who had come from green flag schools themselves came up with the idea. The students wanted to have a say in how the university managed its environmental impact and saw the Green Flag programme as the ideal opportunity to engage with management. In the 10 years since being awarded the Green Flag, UCC has reduced its total waste tonnage per year by 25%. Carbon emissions have fallen by over 35%. All of UCC's campus habitats have been mapped and a reduced mowing regime introduced to support wildflowers. UCC is the only university in Ireland to have its own farm-to-fork programme and the first to launch a single-use plastic-free cafe. Their Green Library campaign received international recognition, saving 930,000 kilowatts of energy consumption, the equivalent of powering an average home for 207 years, or taking a town of 500 people off the grid for an entire year. And they've fully divested themselves of fossil fuels. Well, my hat's off to the students, the management and everybody else associated with UCC. Well, back on the 19th of February, I visited the UCC campus to help John O'Halloran et al. Blow out the candles on their 10th anniversary cake.
Wasn't it fantastic, John, to hear the kids out there today? They were just inspiring, weren't they?
Unbelievable. And what a big group of them, first of all. And secondly, these 5 and 6 year olds talking about really serious issues, weren't they?
Yeah, well, it was depth, right? It was dead, giving this an awful lot of thought. It wasn't just a kind of a, you know, tick in a box. This was really serious discussion.
Oh, it was about climate change. But I heard a student, talk, one of these students, he's probably 9, talking about ecosystem services. Now, in about a second or third year university, we talk about that. And the fact that he's in UCC here today celebrating this green campus is just amazing from these young people.
John, how are you?
Hiya, Derek. Good to see you. You sneaked up on us there.
Kind of earwigging to you there. Yeah. Ecosystem services. My goodness, from a 9-year-old. You better explain to my
listeners. Ecosystem services are simply the services that ecosystems provide. Let me give you a very stark example. When cows were introduced to Australia, they produced cowpats, because we know cows produce cowpats.
Yeah.
And if you don't have proper ecosystem services, another something that's going to decompose the cowpats, we'll be up to a rise in cowpats. So the service that's provided in terms of provision of food, photosynthesis, producing green material for food, for all the things we do, that's an ecosystem service. So these young people at the age of 9 and 10 understand the connections between the world outside, the gases in the air, the soil in the ground, and the interactions with plants to give us food in the world that we live in. And that's remarkable, actually.
Are you telling me that all the primary and national school as well, I presume, students that are here today are teaching you university lecturers and professors?
Well, that's the great thing about a university. You know, our mission here is student-led, research-informed and practice-focused. This is about listening to the student voice. And, you know, the day of the sage on the stage, as we'd say, and so I'm delivering a lecture, has completely changed. So this is about collaborative learning. It's about learning from each other. It's about learning from practitioners like Mark Poland, who's joining us here. Mark is the director of our buildings and estates. And Mark, together with I, have worked mostly with Mark, actually, he's done most of the work, together working with the community, jointly chairing a group of colleagues across the institution to enable this green campus. deliver on its agenda that was initiated by Dr. Maria Curran.
And Maria's here also, so I'll say hello to both of you now. So hello, Mark, and hello, Maria. How are
Hi.
You?
Hi.
So you must be very proud, though, first of all, John, before I come to Mark and Maria, about the green flag. You got it 10 years ago. You're celebrating 10 years, the 10th anniversary. Why is it important, first of all, that the college got the green flag 10 years ago, and why is it important now, 10 years later, to be celebrating it?
I suppose, first of all, the university never had a green flag, so the notion that you would actually reach out to something that's happened in primary and secondary school, we do it all the time in terms of outreach, but this was inward reaching, if I could use that phrase, where the students from the outside actually said, we want something. This is something important. Now, this is 10 years ago. Today, I think people are talking about climate change, we're talking about climate action, we're talking about biodiversity in election manifestos and everything else. Mm-hmm. This is 10 years ago. That was kind of slightly eccentric in those days, but our students said, no, actually, this is important. So the university said, yes, we listen to you, we hear you. But, you know, we can do all of those things, but then we have to live what we do. How do we live what we do? We have people like Mark Poland, who manages our estates, all of the energy, all of the waste, all the transportation. And Mark's role and the team's role is critical in us delivering that, because it makes it authentic. You know, you can't simply say this is important and not do it yourself. And that's where Mark and Maria made all of this possible.
Well, you're my guy today, John. You're going to introduce me to all of the people who helped attain this flag for the school. So you start. You've got Mark and Maria here. Who would you like to start with?
I'd like to start with Maria, because had Maria not 10 years ago, probably even longer, Maria actually is probably 40, but she'll tell me, I'm sure. She came from Mayo to Cork to study zoology, and we're thrilled that she did, because not only did she study zoology and did a PhD, but actually she's changed the face of this university, together with Darren Reedy and other colleagues. I'm just singling those out today, but this is a team effort. So Maria, you must be really proud yourself today, actually.
Yeah, I'm really proud, actually. It's kind of an emotional day, really, because we're looking back, we're celebrating, but we're looking forward as well, and kind of setting out what we want to achieve over the next 10 years, which is really, really vital. To go back to what you were saying about, you know, what's important about the green flag in UCC, if you walk onto the quad in UCC, there's three flags always flying over the quad. Mm. And the green flag is one that is always there. You know, they change depending on what's happening, what's going on around campus, but the green flag always flies there.
Now, for the benefit of people who've never been on the grounds of UCC, now I've just come across the quad and I saw the green flag flying. Describe the campus for people and what that quad is.
Yeah, so I mean, the campus, we're an urban campus. We're just at the edge of the city. We have buildings that date from 1845 to this year, our newest building. And the quad area really is the heart of campus. It's where all the graduates go on their graduation day. It's where all the photos are taken by the president's office. When we bring people in to do tours, it's where they start their tours. And it's where the university began. Yeah. It's where all the decisions are made. And it's a huge thing to have the green flag flying on the quad. And it just kind of embodies the commitment that is here to the green flag programme.
And do all of the students know what that green flag is and what it's about, do you think?
I would say, to be honest, that the majority do, you know. There's still areas where we're not reaching, you know, and we're also we're a huge campus. We have a huge number of students coming in, and we're always working to engage as many as we can. For example, we have an awful lot of international students that come to this campus now as well, many of whom are really, really interested in our Green Campus programme, and many of whom have never heard of it before. And that's, again, part of what's really exciting about this, is that we can bring them in, we can show them what we're doing here, and they can go back to their universities after their year here in UCC and take what we've done with them. So yes, I think the majority of students know that that is a sign that when you're in UCC, you need to be part of Green Campus.
Because a lot of them would have grown up with it. As you said, 10 years ago, this was a bit maverick for a university, but it was starting off in the primary schools and the national schools, so they were familiar, if their school had attained a green flag, have seen that green flag, and they knew why they got it. And it was a big achievement. And then to come to a university that has it too must be important to them.
It is. The whole green flag programme, whether you're a 5-year-old or a 25-year-old, it's all about being engaged and being involved in decision-making. We didn't set out with a specific goal around recycling rates or a specific goal about how much energy we wanted to reduce. We set out with an aim that we wanted to be involved in decision making around environmental management on the campus. And that's what we got. We got the people sitting around a table that had the passion, that, you know, felt inspired by this, that really wanted to drive it. And we also had the people that could make those changes on the ground. And that's what's brilliant about the Green Flag programme.
So were you a student at the time?
I was.
Oh, I see. Fantastic.
So take us back, Maria. I mean, take us back to those moments. And what, you know, why? So the why. So you came from school, and I've just said part of that, but the why? Why did you suddenly say this is important, actually?
I was a member of the Environmental Society, and I guess when I think back to that time, we were hearing a lot more about climate change. It was starting to be in the mainstream press. But we were also hearing a lot of hopeful stories, I guess, you know. So I think 2009 was the time when we realised that actually the ozone layer, the hole in the ozone layer was being fixed, you know. So we were thinking, you know, we knew that there was these environmental challenges happening, but we also knew that actually, you know, we're at that point where we can make a change and we can make things better. And so there had been, the Students' Union, I think for a few years, had been kind of pushing for them to get more involved in environmental management. Recycling was a big issue for students. Recycling still is a big issue for students because they see recycling as something that they have a little bit of control over. If a student is walking across campus, they don't necessarily have control over the lights or the energy that comes in through the grid, mm-hmm. but they have control over where they can put their waste. So recycling was always a really big issue. And there had been a lot of kind of people pushing at the university, I think, and kind of saying, you know, we want this, and really demanding of them changes, but it wasn't really working. So we had come from Green Flag schools where we knew that actually pushing and telling people what to do and arguing and, you know, conflict doesn't work. What works is if you come together. And we knew that the Green Flag framework brought people together, and that's what we wanted to do. So that was the decision. It wasn't my idea. It was another student's idea who actually didn't really... She had the idea, and then I don't think she came back to a single other meeting of the Environmental Society.
But look at the impact she had.
I know. Yeah. I'd love to find her. We took it on anyways.
Well, I'm sure if she's listened to this, she'll recognise herself.
Yeah, absolutely.
So feel free to contact us, and we'll give you the due credit the following programme. So you're working here now.
I am.
Oh,
yes,
very good.
Yes, I get paid to do it now. So I'm the sustainability officer for the university. So I'm based in the Buildings and Estates Department, but I work with John a lot and with our other academic staff, and I work with the students and all.
And can I ask you, is that where you saw yourself as a student if you were studying zoology?
When we embarked on the Green Flag programme, this kind of job didn't exist. I couldn't have imagined that I'd be in this job.
Okay.
I thought I was going to go off to, I don't know, Africa and work in a safari park or something.
Well, you worked on bees, or your PhD
I did my PhD on honeybees. And I'm very, very passionate about research. And like John said, everything that we do is research informed. I did my postdoc on sustainability, but I really got frustrated by sitting behind a computer and researching things. I wanted to be out in front and doing things, you know, really acting on what we need to do. And so then this job came up in 2017 in UCC, and I was lucky to get it.
We referenced, for example, waste. Well, even managing waste requires a lot of work from our colleagues in Buildings and Estates, but managing transportation, energy. So that's where Mark was ready for action. As an engineer himself, who actually was really passionate about this, Mark. I mean, how did it start for you, Mark?
So we have a team of people working on the various strands of sustainability, you know, energy management, which has gone on for an awful long time. Commuting was a big issue for the university and mm-hmm. still is, it's a challenge for everybody. Looking at water management, looking at waste, looking at biodiversity, all those things were being managed kind of, let's say, within our area. But what we lacked was this kind of coordinating voice, somebody to pull it all together and really to work with the academic community, because really the beauty of the Green Campus, as far as we're concerned, is that unique kind of collaboration between the practice people like ourselves, the academic community, the researchers, and our suppliers and contractors all working together. I think that's because we're a relatively small university, I think we can kind of bring that kind of unique kind of flavour together, and that's what really has driven us for the last number of years.
So Derek,
you want to finish up?
I do actually. Look, first of all, thank you for sharing give us the opportunity to share our story
problem.
And listen to a student voice. There's no better way to conclude visiting UCC than finishing with a student voice. This is a comprehensive university where science, where art, humanities are just as important. And I have the privilege of introducing Rebecca. And Rebecca Ducey is going to read us a short poem that she shared with us all today and was very moving and really critical. Thank you.
We spun the earth's beauty into gold, gold that we believed glittered brighter than the sun, and we became shackled to the illusion that the most important things are material, rather than having enough air to breathe. So when the smoky hands of our own corruption grasp tightly around our necks at night, and when the gold we crafted finally dims to null, we will beg for the beauty that we were born from, to free us from the manufactured cage our world has become.
And congratulations again to all of the staff and the pupils, to everybody involved in the Green Flag program at UCC. That's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Niall Hatch and Richard Collins. If you want to visit the website, all you have to do is go to rte.ie/Mooney. Until next week, goodbye.
And Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.